This is the Amp Hour Podcast, recorded August 26th, 2013, episode 160, Queen Ties, Quitch, Quelling.
Welcome to the Amp Hour. I'm Dave Jones from the EEV blog.
And I'm Chris Gammel of Chris Gammel's Analog Life.
What's up, nerd?
Hello, David. I'm glad to hear you're not... What's the word? Dead?
Dead?
Yeah, I think it's the word. Yeah.
Well, I'm probably going to sound absolute
gross.
Crap this show.
Yeah, you're gross.
So, yeah. Yeah. Sorry, folks. I do have my... trigger finger on the mute button, so I'm not good. If you didn't know, I've had a nasty virus for the last couple of weeks, which has pretty much stopped me from doing everything.
And
really,
that, ladies and gentlemen, is why you shouldn't have children.
Right? Yes.
This is what we were talking about before the show. Is that you start having kids, and the kids meet other kids, and they're all germ factories and everything, and it's. It's a bad time for virus time.
It's not pretty.
You know what? Your immune system is getting such a workout right now. It's unbelievable.
I know.
It's just nature trying to knock you off, man.
Right, yeah, I know. Survival of the fittest and all that.
Yeah. Leave some room for other electronics people, huh?
Come on, Darwin. Come on, take me on, you bastard.
Bring it on. Well, I'm glad you're alive. That's good. You know, the same thing happens at work. Usually I get the secondhand effect. All the people like have kids. They come into work still for whatever reason that happens to me. And then, of course, I get it from them. And and the green grass grows all around. Yep.
Well, that's one of the, things. Like, you don't want to... think that you don't want your employer to think that you're just chucking a sickie, as we call it here.
Right.
Because I've got a runny nose, I don't want to chuck a sickie just for that. You want to save it for, I don't know, when the Super Bowl's on or something, right? I don't know. What do you Yanks care about? I don't know. Like a big day, right off.
Not the Super Bowl for me, but...
Right, okay.
Maybe like a Friday night, I don't know.
I'll get a Monday long weekend, morning. Usually. If you've got Monday off, I'll chuck a sickie on Friday,
Yeah. And, chuck a sickie.
But no, chuck a sickie, that's it. So you don't want them to think that you're chucking a sickie, but you don't want to, but you shouldn't go in, because it just... Like, you're actually trying to do good for the company, but at the same time, you're doing bad.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah. Every time, too.
Because go in and give it to everyone else.
Well, and there's pressure to do it, too. Like, I mean, I remember someone in my office.
Yep.
He was like, on death's door. He's, like, hacking up along all the time. And it's like, you got to figure at a certain point, if you're important enough in a company, if you're making these decisions under the influence of, Sudafed and all this other stuff. Like, I've been pretty messed up on just over-the-counter drugs before. Plus, like, my head's all congested. Like, that is just that's not a good place to be in. Like, you are just going to make mistakes then.
Mm. Yep, exactly.
So that's... But you're right. The workplace culture is definitely like that. I mean, it's like, don't be a baby kind of thing. Like that whole mantra, but it's a mess.
Yeah.
Is it different now?
I think we talked about... Is it different now?
Yeah, I mean, you're your own boss, so...
Oh, me? Oh, yeah, kind of. Well, no. Yes and no, right?
Yeah.
Yes, in that I still feel pressure. Oh, I've got to churn out some videos. So I churned out a couple, right?
Yeah.
Even though I was, and they were pretty crap, right? But anyway, I got a couple out there. So, yes, I felt some pressure to continue to actually produce stuff.
Yeah.
So when I shouldn't have. I just, should have just said, bugger it. I'm taking I didn't know it would take 2 weeks, right? I thought it would only be, a week tops.
Yeah.
Because that was the rumor going around, that this you know, a virus that everyone was getting was like one of these five-day viruses, you know. It wasn't over in a couple of days. So I thought, okay, yeah, it'll be a week, you know. Mm. And but no, this is now the third week and I'm still not 100%. Yikes. You don't want to see what's coming out of my...
No, I don't. I don't want to hear about it either. No one wants to know about this, Dave.
Okay. Right.
It's like extreme social media oversharing.
Yeah, exactly. Check out a photo of the one just came out. Look at this.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Yeah. I know. It's pretty bad. Anyway.
So you've been able to keep up with news while you're laying on the couch moaning and... You know, trying to feel better, or is this
no,
more of a...
No, that's all I was doing, lying on the couch, moaning, trying to feel better.
Yeah.
Did anything exciting happen while I've been near death?
Not too much, I guess. I mean, only like 40 stories on Reddit and such.
40.
But a lot of these are timeless, you know. A lot right. of timeless electronics news.
Yeah. There you go. Hmm. Hey, my first crowdsourcing.
Oh yeah, we haven't talked about that yet, have we?
No, we haven't. So we haven't talked about anything yet except what color of stuff I'm coughing up. Ew.
Anyways, how's crowdsourcing? So what did it end up at? I mean, this is for like a PCB ruler too.
This is for a PCB ruler. You know, and I didn't want to do it. You know, I didn't want to make any more of these rulers, but I just made 500 for the Open Hardware Summit, right? So if you go into the Open Hardware Summit, you'll get one before anyone else, I think. When's the Open Hardware Summit?
That is September 5th.
Oh, okay. Then, you'll likely get them before anyone else. They will be in the goodie bag. I've just had word that they've been delivered by the FedEx truck. So, there you go. They should be there anyway. I thought, I didn't want to make any more of these rulers. Too much hassle. But people kept asking me, right, can we have the ruler? And, you know, had to hit my mute button there, sorry.
Ooh.
And this will go on all show. Should have sat this one out too. Anyway, you know, because, like, these things don't cost much, right? And when something doesn't cost much to actually make, usually, you know, there's no point doing it because all the hassle and expense is all in the shipping and the logistics and everything else, right? You know?
Perhaps you don't understand high-margin products, but go on.
Well, high-margin products, I know. But, yeah, like I've always said, I can't understand somebody on eBay who sells something for 50 cents.
Oh, okay, right? I agree
and
with
then
that,
ships
yeah.
it for free from China. It's like, it's just ridiculous, right? Anyway, but I had all these, you know, a whole bunch of people, and somebody on the forum started a thread, and I thought, I'll do a couple of hundred. How hard can that be? You know, maybe a couple of hundred people will want them. So I did a little impromptu. I thought, that'll be an opportunity to try this crowdsource funding thing too. Why not? You know, if it hits the target, then I'll get 500 boards made. You know,
yeah.
And if it doesn't reach the target, sorry dudes. You know, I just won't bother. Yeah. Yep. You know, because you don't get the money. So it sounded like a neat thing. So I, you know, spontaneous spur of the moment thing. I just went and did a Possible campaign, which is the Australian website. Everyone keeps asking, why did I use Possible? Why not Indiegogo or Kickstarter? Because it's Australian, that's why.
Yeah.
So, anyway, you know, I wanted to support Australia. I can't use Kickstarter because I'm not American.
Or Canadian.
And
or British.
Or Canadian, or, yeah, exactly. And Indiegogo, everyone bitches about Indiegogo, so I thought I'd give the Australian mob a try, and they've been good. I didn't bother doing a video or any of that crap, you know. I just put up, here's my rule, if you want one, pledge, you know, kind of thing. And, I woke up the next morning. I did it like 3 o'clock in the afternoon or something. I woke up the next morning and I'd already cracked my target of $2,500 and 500, I think it was, you know, 500 odd boards or something. So in the first day. Yeah.
Very nice. So it ended up, $25,000 plus or no?
31,000.
31,000.
Something
or other. Dang.
31,000. Something or other. which is, sorry, I don't have the stats to hand, but it's 9,000, I think it's 9,700 boards to 2,100 and something people.
Wow. That's a lot of peoples.
Yeah, so that's a lot of peoples. That's a lot of, yep.
Well, that's great,
and,
man.
Yeah, it just went crazy. So now, it's, no. You know.
Now you're a shipping depot.
Now I'm a shipping conglomerate, yeah.
Right. Which is the downside of any kind of online type
exactly.
of sales yep. thing, right? You have to get good at shipping.
Yeah, we've talked about that endlessly.
Yep.
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 Yep. And, you know, it was going to be, oh, okay, I can easily, you know, buy a couple of hundred stamps and ship a couple of hundred envelopes. Not a problem, right?
Yeah.
But now it's a couple of thousand. No, it's a totally different ball game. And now I have to talk to mailing houses and things like that to try and optimize the process. Because, you know, it's gotten to the point where, you know, I was going to, like, I've got one of those label printers, you know, that can print out all the addresses. I've got all the addresses in a CSV file that I download from Possible, and I can put them all in and print them all out. But then it takes extra time. But now you've got to consider all the optimization parts of doing this, right? It takes me an extra, I don't know, 2-3 seconds to peel off that sticker and put it on the envelope, right? Well, you want to optimize that out of the step. So now I'm looking to get, you know, a mailing house to print directly onto the envelopes. And then you go, well, I can't just do stamps now. I can't just go out and buy 2,000 stamps at $2.60 each and peel them off and stick them on the envelopes. Well, you want to optimize that too. So you want to get one of those franking machines or whatever they're called, you know. I'm not sure what they're called in the US, but you can get these official machines from the post office that will print the postage onto the envelope. You know, so, and then you pay the post office or the supplier of the machine, and then, yeah, the money goes to the post office, and, yeah, you don't have to physically put a stamp on there. It's designed for all that high-volume mailing stuff, and, yeah, so I've got to look into that. And I'm probably stuck between that point of, oh, you know, a couple of thousand might be too small a job for a lot of these mailing houses, right? You only want to send a couple of thousand. Ooh, that one off. Ooh, yeah. That's, you know, it's kind of like the, you know, you want to buy reels of components, right? You know, you just want one reel, you know, or half a reel. So, you know, it's sort of that weird, you know, so you've got to end up buying. So you end up buying from DigiKey and paying more than what you get it from your local supplier at if you bought 20 reels or something. So you just, I'm sort of stuck in that.
That's tough, you know, the volume optimization stuff.
But
surely there's someone that will do it all for you. I'm sure you just have to hand over a chunk of cash.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure they'll happily take my money and do it. It's just a matter of whether or not it's worthwhile. Yep. Right. So at the very least, I'm sure I could find somebody to do at least, you know, print my envelopes for me and maybe do the franking postage thing on there, you know, but they may not want to stuff them, right? Because they're used to using, you know, stuffing them with envelope paper, you know, and using their automated folding machines and stuffing machines and all that sort of stuff. So, yeah, I don't know. It's all too hard.
That's okay. It's the curse of success, I suppose.
Right.
Yeah. Well, speaking of that, you're not the only crowdsource game in town for PCBs. There's another one that's coming out from, is it Octopart that's doing it?
Octopart, yes. They just emailed me this morning. Yeah. The CEO of Octopart, Sam. They can't be that huge if the CEO is personally telling me about it. I don't know how big they are. I have no idea. Your friend works at Octopart.
Yeah, my friend Russell does. He, I think it's like 10 to 12 employees or so. I'm not sure how many exactly, but it's small. But they're powerful, right? I mean, Octopart's nice search engine for search a lot of different sites and distributors and stuff. So that's why I like them. And then Circuit Hub, I'm a big fan of too. They use their API, and Octopart API is pretty cool. So I like that.
Cool.
Yeah.
And can anyone get that API, or is it like...
Yeah, I think so. I actually haven't... was actually one of my ideas for Google Glass, was to have a talking... Of course, I needed to learn how to actually integrate the API with all the Glass stuff, but to tap the side and say, OK Glass, look up part, you know, ABC,
oh,
123.
I was going to say, you could do it for a teardown. You could be staring at a part, and you can look at the part number, and you tap it, and you go, tell me how much that part costs, you know?
Yeah. That was the idea I had initially, and then, right. You know, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
Contextual electronics has been eating my life, right. So. but, yeah, so that was the idea, was integrating Octoparts API mm-hmm. for that kind of thing. And a lot of people do. You kind of see the API pop up here and there. But this is a reference PCB that Star Simpson, who did, she actually, her and someone else did the teardown with SparkFun, or, you know, via SparkFun for the Google Glass teardown.
Right.
Star and then Sam from Octopart, they designed this PCB together. And I had talked to Star about it a while back because I was always really frustrated with having, like, the scale of, you know, like... You know, you can kind of keep them in your mind, but not necessarily like mm-hmm. having it like snap decision kind of stuff of, all right, well, it's a SOT23. Is that bigger or smaller than an SOICA? You know, like,
yeah, yep.
Having all those things at once. What I always really, really wanted, and NXP did this. I'll try and link in the NXP document too, because that was a good one. I think I might have mentioned it before, but NXP had a document where they showed a bunch of different footprints, but they didn't show the actual scale. What I've always wanted is like a zoomable document where it's like you start at a big, like, you know, quad flat pack 204 kind of huge, you know, 13 by 13 millimeter kind of package, and then you just keep zooming in, and you get the same detail, but then you can actually compare them one to another. And I think actually KiCad actually does that too. They have, it'll generate a PDF, and there's some CAD programs that'll sort of do this kind of thing, but it's never been as interactive as I wanted it to be.
Yep.
So having these kind of reference cards are great. The layout actually has a whole bunch of different package types in the back. You can kind of see them from the image, but they're, you know, some BGAs, and then kind of working your way down mm-hmm. to 0402s and MSOPs and TSOPs and all those lovely types that we all love.
and it's actually a PCB.
Right.
With on the front is the resistor color code. Now, here's the kicker. They're actually, because it's a PCB, they have to silk screen all the different colors on the PCB.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, the first thing you go is, well, why didn't you just print a card? You know, card. It'll be infinitely cheaper, right?
Yeah.
But of course, it isn't as cool because it's not made out of PCB material, right? But this makes it, it's expensive to print that many different colors on there.
Right. And Star even said in the video that they're actually sending it to a different house just for silk screening. So that probably speaks to the process that's necessary because. Damn.
I know. Not every manufacturer would, you know, give you 10 different colors to start with, let alone do it for you on the one board.
Yeah, right.
It's not easy.
It's definitely going to look cool. And, you know, it's a good reference to have, too. You know, it's all about having that in your pocket, you know, like kind of just being able to pull it out when you need it and reference it.
My only complaint was that it was a three-color resistor code, not a four color.
Right, they left out tolerance, which I was thinking too, and it was like, but I guess those are a little easier to memorize.
The five banded one with the tolerance as
okay, gotcha.
Yeah, I see. I would have split it into, I would have had two separate ones or something on there, but I don't know. But then you got to squeeze it in, and you know.
I mean, it's cool for what it is, though. I mean, it is compact, so it's. That's an interesting side of things.
How thick is it? I don't think they say, do they?
No, I don't. I don't think so. But I would guess 62 mil, whatever that is in metric. Sorry,
mil. Nobody does bloody. Hang on, I'll get my micro ruler.
Oh, your ruler. Oh, this is useful. Yes. You know, I've seen these kind of like comparison boards before too. I every time I see them, I love having them around because there was one I saw for mm-hmm. I had taken a picture of it a long time ago. I was digging through old pictures and I found it actually of someone doing like diode comparisons because they were getting down into like, you know, like SOT 523, SOT 923, like all these crazy small packages, you know. And then you start getting into the chip scale 4-pin BGA type of things. Like, that's like the zoomable document that I, that's what I really want, you know, it's tough. Especially, you know what the tough part is having that comparison, like when you're on like a DigiKey or a Mouser or a Newark type of thing, you know, like being able to, mm-hmm. not just have that list and being able to pull it up, right? Like, so that script we talked about 2 weeks ago, that's really great for seeing, like, the different package types. But those are actually mm-hmm. the same size when you compare them side to side, right?
Yeah.
So not having that scale reference is kind of tough for that kind of thing.
Like, occasionally you get a you can search by chip size. You know, it'll be 5x5 yeah. millimeters.
Right.
You know, and stuff like
right,
that.
Right, but that's always the problem with parametric search, too. You can't just do it by, like relative dimension, you know? Like, what you need is, like, kind of yep, like the hand-wavy, you know, like, about this much, but then this much, but then you're right, talking in millimeters, right. So it's like,
bloody yikes.
I know.
Yeah.
So you figure out with your little handy dandy ruler there?
Oh, right. 64. No, sorry, I didn't look it up.
You're not going to? Not going to. Okay.
1.6. You're talking standard 1.6 millimeter? Sorry, I forgot what value you used. Yeah.
Yeah, I used that 62 mil. Yeah.
Yep.
Or thou, as you were. You like thou. Right.
Thou, mil. I use them interchangeably.
You know, I know.
Even the same sentence. I'm, hopeless.
That's okay. It's all contextual. Don't know why. Yeah, so this is a cool project, though. I like it.
And yes, it's a crowdsource funded thing, folks. And yeah. Once again, they're using yet another crowdsource funded site called CrowdSupply.
Never heard of them.
No, I don't think. I don't know.
There's some where they're like, there's that one where you can actually do your own now. You can like put it, install it on your site.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, like I think it was the lock people? Like remember that like phone enabled lock? I forget the name of it.
No.
Lockatron, maybe? Was that what it was called? I think it was Lockatron. But there was one where like they kept getting rejected from Kickstarter. And they're like, screw this, we'll just write our own.
Which is, okay.
It's like, oh, okay, yeah, a bunch of coders, you know, it's like, that's...
why not?
You know, that's pretty smart.
Right, so it's like a WordPress thing or something, you just install it, do you? And
it's just like, it's just a, a software package you install on a server, so...
Right. I don't know about that. Oh, goodness.
Well,
I guess.
It's just a bidding software and then a payment back end, right? That's
right.
I won't say that's all Kickstarter is, but those are the main components, really. Then the community aspect.
Yep.
I could probably write one, whatever, no big deal. Yeah, right.
Hey, I forgot to mention, you wonder what the shitty thing is, and apparently this happens to a lot of people. One of the downsides is PayPal shut you down.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
For being too popular, it's the curse of the crowdfunding campaign.
Yeah, because that looks like you're a money launderer for some reason.
Protection. Yeah. Your protection, right, in quote marks, even though money's coming into your account.
Yep.
Right, they do it for your protection. And, I ended up with... like 4,500 transactions on my PayPal account.
Dang.
Because you get a transaction for every person who puts in, and then Possible, I don't know how the others do it, Kickstarter and all that, but they take out an individual 5% transaction each time it goes in. So for each person who sends you a pledge, you get 2 transactions on your PayPal account. And sure enough, and they actually warned me, just be careful. They may shut you down, and sure enough, they did.
Wow.
PayPal shut me down, and I actually spoke to a human.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah.
Yeah, I got their number here in Australia, and I spoke to a human in a call center in India, of course. But
of course, yeah.
And they fixed my account in 10 minutes. You know.
Well, that's good.
Unbelievable. I was shocked.
Online business can be dicey like that, though. You know, like it's just crossing so many. Mm. It's like doing like you've complained about in the past, right? Like dealing with components and the U.S. government, like ITAR type stuff, international trade and regulation stuff. Like that's just a mess, right? I mean, like And it's like anytime you cross a country border, you have a whole new set of.
Speaking of which, rules, whole new set of my campaign was the most supported in the whole history of Possible, right? It had the most number of supporters ever. This is,
okay, I'm waiting for the rules part, Dave.
Yeah, well, the rules.
Allow me to toot my own horn a little more.
It actually broke their shipping engine, right? Their shipping engine wasn't good enough. So they've had to rewrite their shipping engine. They've had to redo it.
waiting for the rules here, David.
What?
What was the, you said? Well, speaking of rules, your segue was.
Speaking of, they're not rules, but no postage, like
was
mailing.
This supposed to be
right?
Dave rules. Dave rules.
Oh goodness!
Speaking
sake.
Of rules, Dave rules.
I'm the ruler of Possible.
Oh
get
my
it?
God!
Oh God! Is okay, no more bad. Yeah. Anyway. So, yes, and all the Yanks complained, of course, because this is an Australian website. They all complained that they didn't have a postage field in there when you're filling out your address for city, you know, and all the Yanks got up in arms.
Oh, yeah,
blah, blah, blah. You know, and apparently, they've had to go and rewrite their shipping engine. And my campaign showed up bugs in their CSV download thing as well with all their fields for stuff like that. So they've had to fix those bugs as well, which nobody found before because nobody had used the Australian site to have so many overseas contributors before. Right. It just, you know, Oops, I broke it.
You broke it, man. So I have a question about international stuff since we're talking about crossing lines. I got in an argument this week with a friend about internet hiring people internationally. And I think I already know where you come down on this kind of thing, but how do you judge whether or not to hire someone like in country or overseas?
What do you mean, actually?
So what I was doing is I was
there on a working visa or something. What are you talking about?
No, just like sending
them
work.
To work there?
So I basically what happened was I was hiring someone for a task, and I hired them based on the merit of their application and everything else. And then I told my friend where this person was from, and it was somewhere in Europe, and he's like, well, why don't you just hire someone in the U.S.? And I'm like, because I don't care, right? I mean, like, I care about the quality of the work, not where the person was born. And I wonder about that because, especially in electronics, right? I mean, there is a nationalistic trend for that kind of stuff too, right? I mean, he called me out for saying, like, Chris, you always talk about, bringing manufacturing back to the States, and Dave, you've talked about manufacturing in Australia, right? And we are nationalistic in that way, but where do you really draw that line between, like, if you knew there was a good designer in India or China or, Germany or England, like, how do you really make that decision, right? And I was just curious... He wanted us to talk about it on the show, and I'm like, yeah, I'll bring it up at least.
Okay, well, let's talk about it, I guess. How long's a piece of string? which is a term you didn't know about.
I know it now because of you, yes.
You know it now.
Yeah.
Right. Let's clarify this completely, right? Is this person a U.S. citizen?
He is.
Well, what's the problem?
Oh, wait. Is the friend or is the person I'm hiring?
No, the person you're hiring.
No, I said they're European. They're from the UK.
Oh, they're European and they're working. It's a contract. It's all digital work. Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
But I mean, how do you draw that line, right? I mean, because like I said, we've talked about manufacturing a lot with electronics, right? Mm-hmm. It's good. Mm-hmm. And the point I made was, with electronics, with manufacturing, the main benefit is not like the nationalistic pride or anything like that. It's having something there and being able to walk out to the floor or drive down the street and be like, no, you put that part in the wrong friggin' place, fix it right now. Or you put that part in the right friggin' place, great job. Right? I mean, you gotta have both sides, right?
Or I'll break your legs,
Yeah. I mean, so that's what it was. And it's like, I just wonder what the limits of that are. The reason I'm asking you is because, you always try and source stuff locally, so maybe what your thoughts are on that kind of thing.
Well, I'm a similar thing. The key word there was digital, right? It's all just digital remote work. In that case, I'm like, who cares, right? Like, it, you know, it doesn't matter. Yeah, you go for someone who you know. If you know this person, that they do good work, use them. You know, I got no problems with that at all. But yeah, as you said, when it comes down to local, you know, there's many reasons for having that local manufacturing. And on that aspect, I support the local manufacturer of stuff.
Yeah.
And I, you know, and we can go into the whole, you know, it's, you almost become a hypocrite because you're saying one thing and then you say another. On one hand, you're saying one thing. On the other hand, you're saying something else. You know, it's,
well, yeah, and he was, you know, he was talking about
not black and white like that.
Right. And that's, yeah, exactly. That's the point I got to as well. And it's like, you know, the, he's like, oh, well, you know, if you build your, if you build your business on low cost labor, then, you know, you're going to be dependent on it. And I'm like, look, I'm hiring someone in the UK. This, first off, this is not low cost labor. this is talented labor, right? That's, and that's what it ultimately comes down to, is that in certain things, it becomes purely meritocratic, right? You know, like, it's based on what they can do and not where they live. That's, I don't care. I would rather pay someone $100 an hour to make a design well than to pay someone $20 an hour and have to pay them for 20 extra hours to get the same stuff done, right? I mean, like, it's just, that just seems like the right thing to me. And then it got into all this, like, it wasn't like rah-rah nationalism, but it was just like, oh, you know, like, well, don't you want to hire people locally? And I don't know. I just, I don't really care. you know, like, I'm kind of looking out for number one here.
Once again, I probably would give a preference for someone local, but once again, it comes back to the practical things, like they'd be in the same time zone.
Yeah, that, you know, that was a good point that he made.
Like,
yeah,
you know, like, yeah, of course. Like, if I had two identical people I know could do the job, I'd probably pick the Australian person.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, no,
the
that
local
makes sense.
Person from Sydney, you know, because, well, you know, not due to some nationalistic pride, just because it's just more practical.
Right.
Or it may be, if, you know, shit hits the fan, then, you know, you can just go out and talk to them.
Yeah,
face
that's
to face.
True, too. Yeah. Yeah, and really, it's I started as like this. It seemed like it was nationalistic to start with, but it did evolve into this, all these other arguments that actually did come up at one point or another. But, you know, it's just, it's interesting because it's just the reality that we live in these days, right? I'm sure that some of our listeners out there, you know, I think about like people who are consultants, you know, you can get, if you're, especially if you're a specialist in some area, or you find a group of people that, say you're working with, like, you know, you're really good with quadcopters or something like that, right? If you have one, if you're a consultant in one area and a group of people get to know you, those same group of people is going to keep calling you, and people, you know, competitors and others, just because you get a reputation, and that's a really good thing for a business, right? But it's just a, it's not always going to be that same company that calls you is going to be down the road. They might be, you know, next continent over. So it's just the reality of living in internet age, I guess.
Well, that's the thing. When I was a boy, well, you know, this thing wasn't even an option. Geez, be thankful you've got the option these days to, you know, do this sort of stuff. Back when, you know, phone calls cost, you know, $100 for 10 minutes, and international phone call was $100 for 10 minutes, and there was no internet. And, you know, I mean, these sort of things just, you know, geez, you wouldn't even work with somebody interstate back then.
Oh, really?
You know, that was a big deal, right? Yeah. That was a big deal because, you'd have to do an interstate phone call. That costs a lot of money, you know. that costs more than just your local. Yeah, you know, it was a big deal back then, seriously.
See, now, you know? I guess the real question then is, though, like, you know, there's a lot of churn in that case, right, because there's a lot of manufacturing inefficiencies and everything like that. But then I wonder about, you know, like, as we move into, like, an age of robots, there's an article on the subreddit about, like, robots and stuff. And just, like, you know, like, robots are potentially a threat towards certain jobs, but usually the idea is that other jobs open up. But I wonder about that as just a, you know, if you think about each small area of, you know, a country or a region being, like, trying different things, eventually the best process is going to pop out of that, right? And so I wonder if, like, some of this lack of churn and waste actually, you know, obviously we talked to Eric last week about, you know, like, less waste, but, you know, like, having that waste as just kind of like a development lab in a manufacturing environment, right? Like, company A does it this way, but down the road, company B does it that way. And then because company B can get it done a little bit faster, it becomes like a survival of the fittest, right? Like you talked about your
sickness. Right, of course. Darwin always wins, folks.
That's right. Yeah.
Oh, dear, dear. Meh.
Meh. All right.
Meh.
Meh.
Meh. I'm just, you know, yeah, I don't see the argument here, really. I just...
Okay.
use whoever you want to use.
Okay. I will. God.
Because ultimately that's what people are going to do anyway.
Yeah.
You know, you can't... Well, no, you can try and mandate this by law, right?
Oh,
and a lot of countries
no, that's
do
terrible.
That, right? X amount of... You know, X amount of, X amount of your project, this government project must be supplied by Australian suppliers.
Right, yeah.
Or whatever. That's very common, especially in the military and other big, you know, industrial kind of things that the government give a toss about.
Right.
So, And even in the US, right, you guys have lots of state-based rivalry, right? Like, oh, all the jobs must stay in the state and all that sort of jazz.
Sometimes, yeah, there's like government contracts and all that crap, like politicians fighting to bring stuff back, but that's a mess. That's no good.
Right. Once again, meh. Next. Goodness. Hey, that's stupid. Come on, finish the crowdsource funding. Crap,
no.
That's stupid. Ubuntu Edge thing's not going to hit its target.
Oh, yeah. Even though they got $11 million pledged. Yeah.
$32 million. They're like $20 million short with 2 days left or something. Whoop-de-doo.
Yeah. I'm not too surprised.
Yep. Let's
there
not
are
mention
limits to
them
this
again.
Kind of stuff, right? It's like, yep. Oh, well. Well, if you want to go the other direction, if you do want to, instead of giving up money in order to buy something, you could offer up something that other people might want to buy, and you can get paid for it. Also known as, companies stop doing R&D and instead try and crowdsource designs. So Samsung is currently running a contest for up to $10,000, basically, if you integrate a flexible... screen, you can get up to 10 grand for it. And of course, it's all voting and everything else and the usual contest crap. But I don't know. I don't think this is... I don't think anything would actually ever good come out of this. You know, like, it's like... Yeah, you might get some ideas, but... I think there is something to be said about the, you know, the designer ethic. You know, like, not the ethic even, just like the... Having smaller people, the smaller teams that actually design stuff versus crowdsourcing on ideas is sometimes just doesn't strike me the right way.
What are the terms and conditions of this thing? Like, what happened? Do you sign over your rights? What is the?
Oh yeah. Let's see. Feasibility. Yeah. Official rules. There we go. Yeah, but I mean, come on, these things are always, you know, especially the bigger company you get, you know, the rules are always like, we own you, we own your idea, everything you do for the rest of your life. Of course, that's hyperbole, but, you know, it's, and then like, if you're not in an eligible state, they basically, when you have a lawyer actually look at the contest rules, that gets...
Your lawyer has a heart attack.
They do, yeah, oh yeah.
Yeah.
You gotta have something small and stupid and done quickly and shoddily, like the 555 contest.
Right.
That's the only way it's ever fun, and not for the people that put it together.
Oh boy.
Yeah.
And they don't get much bigger than Samsung, so yeah, I'm sure they've got this thing.
Oh yeah, this is a
so legally
11 page
tight,
document,
you know,
on how to
right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah.
Fail.
Yep.
That's a fail.
So what have you been working on in the lab? Anything lately? It's mostly cough circuits?
Cough circuits. No, nothing.
Nothing?
Just, you know, moping around the house. I've hardly even been to the lab.
Jeez.
Odd enough, it still works. You know, I get back there and there's cobwebs and everything.
Turn the lights on even. You know, the light bulbs pop. Mm.
they flicker and just die. Yeah. You know? Yeah. Oh, boy.
I've been in the throes of troubleshooting lately, and I had possibly, I don't know how much of the details I can talk about it, but I had one of the...
So it's work, obviously.
Yes, it's work. It's one of the most frustrating problems I've ever had before today.
Is it like, analog or digital?
It ended up being both, actually. but you know, like the phrase, the mark of an insane man is to do the same thing over and over again.
Yeah, over and expect different results.
And expect different results, right? Well, I got into a situation today where I was forced. I ran out of other options. I was forced into insanity today, and it turned
just
out.
Just keep pushing the button, monkey style.
I know.
Work.
What it ended up being, the situation at least was. I had these pluggable units, right? And between unit A and unit, or sorry, there's base A and base B that I was plugging into. It would work in base A, and it wouldn't work in base B.
Oh, and so, I've had those. Yeah.
Oh, my God. Yeah. It was the worst thing I've ever... Not the worst thing. That's a lie.
Yep.
I've had problems that went on for, 2.5 weeks with that kind of insanity. But this was a single-day thing. But, yeah, that same kind of thing of it works here, it doesn't work here. It's the same thing. Yeah. What the hell's going... And honestly, difference was, it seemed like it was geographically based. So, of course, my mind started racing to all these different things. I'm like, oh, are there, magnetic fields over here? Oh, is it a weird ground plane that it's attached to? Or, what's going on here, right? And it was... Of course, it was nothing like that, but...
right, no, that's right. Yep.
What was the one that you've experienced in the past?
Oh, I've had ones where, similar thing, it'd work in Chassis A and it wouldn't work in Chassis B, right? And it turns out that, marginal capacitive loading differences between the builds in the two units, it was so on, the design was so on the edge that it'd work in one and not in the other. And as you say, you move it around and that would sort of jiggle the internal stuff and it'd sometimes work and sometimes wouldn't. And, and it slightly changed with temperature. And of course, if you put it in this corner of the room, that's under the air conditioning outlet. Yep. Yeah. So you're getting half a degree cooler in that side of the room and that's enough to cause it to, and then you start being technical minded, you start thinking of the most complex reason possible.
Of course, you're right.
Right? And then that just leads you down so many garden paths. It's just ridiculous.
And I started looking at the layout and everything, and I looked at your mind just goes, you're right. Your mind goes everywhere, right? I mean, I start, and especially with analog problems, you think about temperature, you think about, vibrational type stuff, what's it called, the microphonic effect or whatever.
Phonics,
that is
in your surface mount caps. If you actually, all you got to do is put your coffee, sometimes you would have a fault where you put your coffee mug down on the table and that would cause it to trigger, because there's a little microphonic effect going through to your board.
And you want to talk about exercise and insanity when you walk by someone's cube and you just see them tapping on their desk.
Right.
Bill, are you okay? I just got to get it. I got to get it to happen again.
And it all comes down to some fundamental theory. When I had that problem with the static discharge from the chair, right? Every time I got up from my chair, would cause an electrostatic impulse, which would then be picked up by the circuit, which would cause it to trigger an hour later, or do get into mode, which then causes an error an hour later. So you wouldn't correlate the two.
An hour later,
Wouldn't correlate the two, because it's a long-term data logger. So you wouldn't, So you can't possibly correlate the two. It's just next to impossible, and just weird things like that.
Yeah.
I've had tons of those weird electromechanical, you know, vibrational, temperature, shock, all sorts of, you know.
Yeah. I think the thing that I really like doing, and actually what ended up helping me today, is following the current. I mean, obviously that's a pretty common thing, but maybe for the younger people out there, but just being able to do like voltage stack ups. So you know that there's 1 amp of current flowing in this 10 ohm resistor. And it's like, okay, you know, there better be 10 volts at the top of that resistor or else something's wrong, right? It's, you know, it's getting diverted somewhere. Right. Like that has almost, you know, usually there's some component of that in the analog side of things, you know, at least DC analog, right? Because you start getting into AC, high frequency AC stuff, and then your cap starts shunning stuff away. But, you know, like that method usually helps me maintain sanity. that's the important thing.
So thou shalt test voltages.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you always talk about
first
rails.
First rule of troubleshooting, yeah.
But yeah, the stack up is what really, you know, and writing, you know, having paper still, you know, hey.
Yeah, yeah, writing stuff down, yeah.
Right, writing the stack up on your schematic too. That'll save your I feel like I could have gone bald today with the amount of hair I was ripping out, so.
Right. Did you solve it?
I did solve it, yes. It was
And
a
you
hard
can't tell
battle.
Us what the
Well, it was a voltage stack up thing. That's what I can tell you.
Oh, it was. Okay.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
But what was causing it? What was
Bad assumptions, really. So like current was flowing somewhere that I didn't think would be flowing. And it was flowing in different modes effectively. So
okay, so this is a new design issue, is it?
Yeah.
Not
really.
Right. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Right. Right. And this is what, the first time you built the prototype, is it?
Yeah. Yep.
Right. And you didn't simulate it?
I did simulate it, but I changed stuff last minute. That's another thing, right? When you start getting into changes, like, you know, that's another thing that I've been noticing a lot lately too. You know, as you get towards like release dates and stuff like that, you can kind of sense that tension. Like, you know, I always had these very friendly, you know, interaction with my coworkers always, but man, it's like that palpable edge that people start getting towards. You know, it's like as you get towards dates. It just starts to get different, and it's like I don't fault anyone for it, right? It's just always
everybody's
got their own thing to do, and it's just it's human nature, right? But that's when you really make the crazy mistakes, because you're like, well, just try this. No, try this. Just try anything. try everything. And that's
goodness.
That's when it really gets bad. And you can never prepare for that stuff either, right? I mean, like, it's not like you're sitting at the beginning of a project, you know, a year beforehand being like, well, I'm probably gonna freak out in about 12 months. You know? Oh, I probably won't have thought of the following things, and I'll probably freak out. So it's just tough to deal with.
Oh, goodness.
I'm amazed by things like this. You see this backscatter communications thing? Like, I think about things that are difficult to test and difficult to work with. And then this backscatter method of communicating, it's just like, how do you test this shit?
I mean, write it and it works or it doesn't. You know, you just write your code and does it work or it doesn't. You know, first hat. If it doesn't work, well, how do you start troubleshooting it?
Yeah. So what this is, though, it was Dangerous Prototypes who posted about this, but it's actually people from University of Washington. Basically, the idea is you have an antenna and then a PCB that's attached, and then by either absorbing or reflecting ambient RF signals, like you know, like TV stations, so you might pick a certain frequency, the resonant frequency, whatever your antenna is. You can basically transmit information. And so their demo they show is like swiping your finger across like a cap touch pad or whatever. And then being able to translate that, you know, on or off characteristic to the little widget next to it, both of which don't have batteries.
And both widgets don't have batteries. They're just getting the parasitic power from the...
Right, but it's actually...
then modulating that.
Right. Well, the modulation being like, kind of, I'm going to steal all of the localized RF, or I'm going to just reflect it. That's kind of the idea.
Yep.
And the only thing I didn't get about this demo was that they showed like an RFID type of demo where they they transferred quote unquote money from one device to another. But in that case, I think you would need enough power to power something that actually would be able to control, you know, like your bit swapping. Because if you're going to translate, okay, Dave, I'm giving you, you know, 5 Australian crazy Aussie bucks. I need to know what the actual bit pattern is to make that transfer, right? And it's like, so then you'd have to power the thing that does that bit flipping, right?
Well, here comes the, you know, the crux of this thing. What use is it, right?
Yeah.
It's like, you know, yeah, it's great. Okay, fantastic, novel, terrific, you know, golf clap. Okay, everyone applaud them, yay. And, you know, fantastic for doing this. But then, like, what's the practical application?
Well, I don't think they're at that stage. I mean, this is a paper,
because,
really.
Because you have to rely on some sort of potentially intermittent ambient signal. It's just stupid. Just put a battery in the thing. Like, you know, I mean, seriously, it's, you know, yes, it's novel, but who would rely on this technology? Under what circumstances would you rely on using, on there being this ambient condition?
Well, I mean, it's from like a swath of the spectrum, though, Dave. I think it's like there's always energy in the spectrum. That's the idea.
Come on, no.
It's an academic paper. This is an academic exercise.
Yeah, exactly. It's an academic exercise.
Yeah.
When the you know, as you said, like the power is so low and the amounts of data are so low, but then you've got to do some processing on the data, like, you know, you may as well, you could power these things for a year on a coin cell battery anyway, so why not just do that?
Right.
You know, and then avoid any potential issues with the backscattering and ambient signal. I mean, it's just, it's pointless. Is anyone else with me? I mean,
I'm sure there's a couple people with you.
Yeah, I thought
it
was novel when I saw it too, but.
Yeah, it's novel. Yeah, that's a good way to say it.
It's novel, but that's where it's going to stay, right?
Well, maybe. You never know with this kind of stuff, you know?
Maybe. Oh, yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
No, but any technology which relies on, you know, random ambient stuff is just,
Say definitely if it was, you know, talking about like energy harvesting for that kind of, like, that's always crap.
Of course.
You know, like
course,
RF energy harvesting is like, what are you guys doing here? You know?
Well, no, there's a couple of niche applications where it's useful.
Maybe.
There's a couple of niche applications, right?
Yeah, if you're in a really high RF density area, you know, I think that would be maybe, but yeah.
Oh, dearity. Anyway.
All right, well, we don't really know what's going on there anyway, so let's just leave that for now. Speaking of other things that I don't understand, or I did not understand, I thought this was brilliant. So remember those movies or YouTube videos a while back where it was like an LED circuit and the guy would like flip switches and LEDs would turn on? Well, he finally posted all of his schematics, not like people guessing at him. Like, a lot of people got them right.
Right.
But he posted all of his schematics, and are brilliant. How he actually did it. I mean, like, he's bypassing stuff with a lot of inductors. He actually had, like, signal generators inside the battery stuff. Yeah. Oh, it was – I love this kind of stuff. I hate puzzles.
Very cool.
I mean, I know that, like, that's very anti-engineer, but I just want the answer normally.
exactly. There's more elegance in the answer than trying to figure out the solution.
Yeah, I can appreciate it without bashing my head into the wall, but why I'm not a researcher, right? I know this.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
So, these are really, really fun. I mean, like, just like how he was – the mystery behind it and everything. So he's posted all of his LED stuff. It's a lot of fun.
Very cool. Yeah, so he's bypassing LEDs with inductors and diodes.
Yeah,
and
a lot of that kind of stuff.
Capacitors and,
It is a little more complicated than I thought it would be. I will say that.
I expected there to be this complexity in there.
Yeah.
You know? And there's more, once again, there's more than one way to skin a cat here. You know, he's done it all RF trap kind of, so to speak, or, you know, frequency trapping kind of analog method. But there, you know, there's other ways to do it as well.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, neat.
Another neat project that I don't know how much press it got, but this is Todd, someone I know actually from locally, but I really love this project. So Todd Bailey and a couple of his friends, they took old CRT vector monitors. Do you know what what the difference is between a vector monitor and a normal monitor?
A vector monitor, they come from the TV days. Are we talking about TV vector monitors?
I believe so. I think the way he explained it to me is that, like, it doesn't have the raster already built into the set. So basically, you have to drive it to all the different locations from, like,
Right. No, I'm thinking of something else. Sorry.
So it's kind of like it's like an oscilloscope, effectively, that kind of screen, but like much bigger. Yep. And so him and some friends, they basically, it was an FPGA project. So they built a driver for this vector monitor, and then they wrote this old school Asteroids demo for it.
Yeah,
this is actually a couple weeks old now, but the demo is just like really awesome. You know, it's like old school graphics and everything. But then if you actually dig down into the tech, I've talked to Todd a lot about it too. If you dig down into the tech, you know, like it's a lot of really cool. You know, driving mechanisms and like all the logic behind it. Then he actually built the driver boards and everything. So definitely a cool project to check out if you like, you know, FPGAs interface into analog. And of course, right there, you got my attention. Yep. So
cool.
Yeah.
And of course, everyone, you know, a lot of people have a vector scope. They have an oscilloscope, you know, which can be pressed into service often for that sort of thing. But this comes from the old Vectrex. You remember the Vectrex game? This is before you were born. Anyway, the Vectrex was a vector graphics-based video game system. And a lot of the arcade nerds out there will know what I'm talking about. And it did that. You know, it actually drew a ship as a triangle, you know, on the screen rather than, you know, dots and a raster-based system, as all the other video games were back then. This one actually did it using vectors, and it's called the Vectrex. Google it, my son.
I shall.
There you go.
Yeah.
I always wonder why. I remember seeing one of those in the local shopping center back in the 80s and lusting after that, you know. I just thought it was incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, magic. This looks like it. I mean, like, it just kind of shows, like, how hard it was to build this stuff back in the day, too, because, I mean, obviously, Todd's doing this with an FPGA, but like think about doing it with discrete logic and everything too, and it gets crazy. So,
yeah,
it's and a lot of high speed DACs and op amps and everything too. Lots of awesomeness. So,
got it.
Oh, what else? What else? What else?
You're involved in a meetup.
I am, Martin.
Cleveland meetup.
Yes, and I didn't mean to mention that to everyone, so thank you. So we co-opted a potential Amp Hour tagline. We're calling it Charged Conversation.
Oh, dear.
Yes. So if people are in the Cleveland area, or if you're coming through Cleveland, or if you want to start your own, I mean, I don't care if you start one in Sydney, perhaps, or, you know, the Silicon Valley. Basically, it's just going to be people, you know, drinking beers, talking circuits. That's kind of the idea. So hopefully it works. And beer is optional, of course, but, you know, hanging out, getting to know people in the local area. That's a really important thing. Because I've kind of been realizing, like, as I sit in the back in my cave, you know, I interact with my coworkers, but it's not that often. And it's like, I know that, like, the engineer, you know, stereotype, but sometimes I just, you know, I want to bounce ideas off of people. That's the real value, I think, of, I mean, having coworkers is nice from a social aspect, but, man, like, there is nothing better than, like, being able to bounce an idea off someone, just to even talk out your problems, right? I mean, obviously, I could do it once a week.
Right.
You know, like, and that's just a really nice thing to have. So having that in a in a meetup capacity is good, too, you know, once a month getting together. And hanging out and talking about projects and stuff.
I thought about doing that as well. Because, yeah, I am, yeah, one of your stereotypical antisocial engineers.
Yeah.
You know, I just don't like, you know, hanging out with other humans, really.
You should start a charge conversation group in Sydney. We can just make it, the name could be like a, you know, a, and then there could be one in New York and one in LA and, you know.
Well, I already have this thing called the EEV blog, if you haven't heard about that. You know, I could use that brand.
Yeah, but you can't, well, maybe you could have EEV blog meetups elsewhere. But anyway, I guess you could do that.
You think Amp Hour meetups are superior to EEV blog meetups?
No, I'm not calling it an Amp Hour meetup. I'm just saying it's called the Charge Conversation meetup with MJ Lorton and the Amp Hour. So that's why, because we couldn't call it just one, because it's me and Martin.
Oh, right, of course, of course.
I got to hang out with Martin again, and you know, he says hi.
Cool. Yeah, because he's got, oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Say hi back.
Yep, it's good to know other humans in the area. Actually, I got to hang out with Dale Doherty too. He was he came through town for the editor of Make or publisher of Make.
No, there you go.
Yeah, real nice guy. Yeah. So it was, that's good. I like getting to know people like that. So.
Well, I'm having a visitor this Friday. Somebody's dropping by the lab.
Oh, really?
Yeah, a Yank. Yeah, he's coming over here.
Nice.
So he thought,
turn on the camera.
You know, drop by, you know.
Very cool.
Yeah, why not? You know.
Don't get him sick.
Right, yeah. Yeah. Might not be good. Yeah. But he's like my second visitor to the lab in like 2 years, you know.
Well, it's not like you have like a sign on the door like stop on
no,
in.
No, yeah, exactly.
I'm sure you'd have some more if you offered. So it's
right.
Yeah, Dave, don't worry, folks. Dave will do a meetup eventually. He was really excited when we started talking about this idea at the beginning, and then, of course, he got sick. So he'll come around eventually, and then he'll be like, oh, I've always wanted to do this kind of thing, like he always does.
I've always talked
about doing a radio show with some nerd from Cleveland. Oh, I've always talked about doing crowdsourcing, yada, 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 yada. Sure, Dave. Yeah. We all believe you.
Yeah.
Speaking of meetups, though, I am still working on the venue, but we will be having one at the Open Source Hardware
Open
Summit.
Open Horse Summit?
Yes, the Open Horse. The Open Horse Summit is down the road. It's a equestrian dissection group, but the Open Source Hardware Summit will be in Boston, and we'll be having a meetup. I've already set up a tour of I talked to the guys at Bolt, the hardware accelerator there. So we will be getting a tour Thursday night, but we'll be having an event around that as well. And looking forward to it. Hopefully a lot of people that are going will be able to hang out. Like we talked to some of the folks from SparkFun will be there and everything. So
right.
Excited about that. Definitely will be, you know, making fun of Dave for not flying overseas for it, that kind of thing.
Have you finished the Amp Hour swag?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it's all done.
It's all done. See, I haven't seen it, folks. So if it sucks ass,
it's all me.
It had nothing to do with me.
Yep. It's all me. That's right. Yep. And if it's awesome, it's all me.
Right.
It'll probably just be meh.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, goodness sake. Cool. So there is Amp Hour swag and there's EEV blog swag in the Open Hardware Summit bag.
Yeah, and I saw where I met Dale down in Akron at Tiny Circuits, they're going to have a board in there too. So there will be at least three PCBs inside the bag, which I think is more than they've had in any other years, which was surprising to me and Dave when we were talking about
it. That is very surprising, yeah.
So
yeah, I thought, you know, because they're cheap and they're easy to do. And
they're durable,
you know,
and they're
lots
fun.
And you can do lots of useful things with them. So yeah, I'm surprised there's not more. I'm surprised the bag isn't filled with PCBs, actually.
Right, yeah. Well, I'm sure they will be eventually.
Right.
Yeah.
After we pioneered the way.
Oh, of course, yeah. Let's see. Anything else on the list that you want to talk about?
Oh, bloody hell. I don't know. World's largest antenna. Yeah.
What about that quad Kickstarter? Did you see that thing? There's actually a new... It's like an off-the-shelf Kickstarter, but it's already hackable and everything. Or It's an off-the-shelf quadcopter, rather. Sorry.
Ah, right. Okay.
Yeah. So I was thinking about you for that because of your canyoning idea.
Yeah, it's gotten to the point where, yeah, we've bumbled around on our canyon copter idea so long, it's like, well, there's no point doing it yourself anymore. You just buy the off-the-shelf bits and there's your solution, you know, and maybe some code, you know, whack on some sensors and some code. But the physical aspect of it, you know, there's so many people doing so many of these things.
Yeah, right.
Off-the-shelf now, it's just, you know, they just work, you know.
Yeah. So, well, and that drives the price down, of course. It's like, you know, 3D printers as well, you know, that drives the price down. It gives more variety. You can make them hackable and everything. And the thing that's always interesting to me about that kind of stuff is that, you know, like, most people don't care about any of the stuff under the hood. I mean, not like our people, right? Not like the people listening to this. Yeah. But like, if you're selling to the public at large, they don't want the fiddly bits. They don't want the early adapter stuff. They want the application layer stuff, right? They want what you were trying to do with that kind of thing of, I want a quadcopter that flies in canyons, right? So if you just write the software that makes it navigate canyons and put some floaties on it, like you talked about, and some waterproof cameras, like, that adds enough value that that becomes an entirely new product then. Exactly. And it's kind of crazy seeing that stuff from a, you know, from the maker perspective, and kind of as the maker movement grows up too, that's going to keep happening, I think, of, you know, this different layers built on top of each other, like Ninja Blocks, right? That was, you know, built on top of the Beagle Bone, right? Most people don't care about the Beagle Bone, but the Ninja Blocks is more of a compelling case. And then, you know, maybe there's something else that actually, maybe there was an appliance that integrates a Ninja Block in it, right? And eventually you have to get cost out, but it's interesting just seeing each of the layers kind of built on top of one another.
Yep.
Not like layers.
And people who buy 3D printers, shock horror, just want to print shit. You know, they don't want to dick around with it.
Right, right.
You know, and, well, yeah, they're not quite there yet. But,
no.
You know, but anyone who produces one that just works regardless of how, you know, how you don't maintain it.
Yeah.
And it just continues to work and work and work no matter how much you abuse it and not maintain it, then, well, they're going to win.
This is actually Dave asking for a 3D printer, folks, if you couldn't tell.
Yes, that actually works. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, and then early adapters kind of yell about it, and that's okay. We've been in the yelling group as well.
Oh boy!
All right.
That reminds me, I've got to finish making. Well, I've got to start. Sorry, making my thing for the Sydney Maker Fair.
Oh yeah! Did we ever have enough guesses on that? I stopped watching the thread. We actually did post a thread about it.
There's a thread there. A couple of dozen. A few pages of guesses. So I won't say if anyone's right or wrong yet. We'll leave it until the end.
And, yeah.
The person wins.
All right.
Maybe. We'll see. That's if I can actually get it built.
Yeah. Well, that's that too. Let's try and get healthy first. Next week on the Amp Hour, we will have Michael Osman of HackRF and the Ubertooth Project, both of which have, HackRF is still in process. It'll actually be, the funding campaign will end the day of when our recording's released. So if you're interested in that, look at that first, because you won't be able to listen to our show and then be like, oh, that's so awesome, I wish I saw it. So definitely look at it first. But you can also look at Ubertooth is another thing that he worked on, which was an open source Bluetooth debugging kit that we actually did talk about in show 49, I believe. And it's a cool little project, and it's still going. It's all open source and everything. So Michael will be on here next week, and we'll talk all about RF and SD, that HackRF is an SDR.
Excellent. Yep.
And he's crossed his $400,000 threshold on his Kickstarter.
Oh, so he has, right. So it's definitely
Go up. His threshold was $80,000 to make it. His $400,000 was his stretch goal, and now he's going to also release a 2-day course that he does for software defined radio. So
We'll talk all about that. But he's definitely met his original funding goal.
Oh yeah, yeah. He blew past that.
Yeah,
so,
awesome.
Yes, it's exciting. It's gonna be good.
When can we see the first Chris Gamble crowdsource campaign?
When I make something that's worth crowdsourcing, how about that, Dave?
Right. Okay.
For now, there's just Contextual Electronics.
That's not stopping anyone else.
Yeah. Well, that's true. But no, Contextual Electronics is signups coming. So I'm doing traditional, you know, sign up and then you pay me money and then we do a course together. So I guess that's crowdsourcing in that you sign up early. You pay before you start.
right.
Yeah. But we'll have hardware by the end. Cool. All right. I guess we'll feel better, man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Try it.
I'm going to go make
more
videos.
Not only have that... Well, I've got to go talk to mail-in houses. Yay me. Bloody hell.
Yep. And that's why I don't do crowdsourcing.
Being successful sucks, folks. Yeah. That's what we're saying.
Yes,
you know,
boo-hoo. We all really feel bad for you, Dave. So.
Yeah, right. Okay. Goodness.
All right, man. We'll see you next week.
Bye.
Whiny, 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 whiny.